Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me. There we go. Here's the title of the talk, An Alternative View of Ensemble Learning. The main point of this slide is to emphasize that this is joint work with Bogdan Popescu, who was also at Stanford at the time. The problem I'm addressing is the predictive learning problem, or sometimes called the supervised learning problem. It's been addressed in talks here yesterday as well, but I thought it might be worthwhile to formally define what it is, the problem we're trying to solve. So the problem we're trying to solve is that we are given data, which is represented as a set of measurements, joint measurements, on a set of observations. So there are uppercase N observations, and vector C here represents a collection of measurements on those observations. We take one of the attributes of variables, and it's very special. It's called the output or response variable, or sometimes called the outcome variable. And the others are called input or predictor variables, and I'll use lowercase n to indicate the number of predictor variables. And so you're given such data, which we presume to be drawn from a random sample from some joint distribution on all the allowed values of joint values of the variables. And we're also given a loss function which characterizes or expresses how much it costs us or how much we lose when we predict a value f and the true value is y. Now, in most procedures, we take that loss function for granted. We use squared error loss or something. But actually, loss functions are quite important. So given this setup, here's the problem. We want to estimate that function, which I've called f star of x, which minimizes amongst all possible functions of x the expected value over the joint distribution of our variables of the loss when we predict y with f of x. So that's the problem. We want to estimate that. If we had the joint distribution, we could just compute it. Now, why are we interested in this problem? We're interested in it because we presume that later on we will be given new observations for which we'll know the joint values of x, but we won't know the value of y, and we want to then predict or estimate the value of y given those joint values of the x's. And this function f star that I defined on the previous slide is the best, by definition, is the best predictor of y given x under whatever loss function you're using. Here are some examples of loss functions in regression where the outcome variable and our prediction, of course, for it take on numeric values. Then absolute loss, which says that your loss is proportional to the size of your error, is sometimes used. More often we use our loss to be proportional to the square of the error, not because we really believe that's how much we lose, but because algorithms for minimizing this tend to be a lot easier than minimizing this or other loss functions. Okay. In classification problem, where both y and f will take on a set of discrete categorical values, that is the class labels, this loss function then becomes a discrete k by k matrix that again characterizes how much it costs you when you predict f and the truth is y. Now this function f star of x, this optimally predicting function, has a name. It's called the target function in regression, and in classification it's usually called the target concept. Now here's our problem. Our problem is that we want to find another function of x that can serve as a suitable approximation to this optimal target function. And we're going to get that approximation by applying some learning procedure to the data. Okay, and there's lots of learning procedures. We've heard about some very good ones yesterday. We'll hear about some more very good ones later on, but today and tomorrow. But among the most successful, well, here are some learning procedures: CART, MARS, logistic regression, discriminant analysis. There's many more that can fill 100 transparencies. Here I'm going to focus on learning ensembles. Learning ensembles of late have emerged as among the more successful and most accurate methods for doing predictive or supervised learning. And two examples are TreeNet or MART is one example of ensemble methods. AdaBoost is another, random forest, which we'll hear more about later this morning, or is another ensemble method. So I'm going to talk about learning ensembles. Okay, now, I'm going to take a rather bizarre view of learning ensembles, unorthodox, alternative, and I'm going to view them this way. Namely, we define a function of the predictor variables that's characterized by a set of parameters. If you change the joint set of the parameter values, you'll change the function of x. Okay, we'll call that the base learner, or you might call it a basis function. Okay. Now, as the parameter values range over all their possible joint values, where here this P represents a space of all possible joint values of the parameters, okay, you generate different functions of X. And in fact, as P ranges over all of its possible values, you will generate all possible base learners, and that's our ensemble. And of course, if these parameters are numeric, then your ensemble will in fact be have an infinite number of members. Okay, and what we're going to use is a linear combination of all ensemble members. And that's why I've expressed this as an integral here. That is, we take a linear combination. This A of P is a function of the parameters. That's the coefficient of the base learner indexed by the parameters P summed or integrated over all possible values of P. Okay? So that's our basic model. And if we had an infinite amount of data and an infinite amount of computing time, we could define a base learner and just use that. But of course we don't. Here are some examples of base learners. In the neural networks, people like to use squashing functions or sigmoid functions, where here P indexes a linear combination of the variables. In multivariate adaptive regression splines, parameters that characterize the base learner are the variables and the knot locations on those variables, the variables you choose to put knots on and the locations of the knots. In the case of decision trees, which are used as ensemble members for both MART and Random Forest and AdaBoost, the parameters are the variables you choose to split on and the locations of the split points and the values you assign to the terminal nodes. So these are some examples of base learners that will comprise our ensembles. I will focus, of course, on decision trees, which have been most widely used as ensemble base learners. Okay. Now, the first problem we run into with my definition of using all the members of the ensemble is we have to do, for each prediction, if we go back up here, for each prediction, we have to do an integration over all possible parameter values. And it's not likely for any interesting base learner that this integral can be expressed in closed form. So we're going to have to do this integral numerically. And in order to do this integral numerically, we have to go to the numerical analysis literature, namely numerical quadrature. Now, there's been many books written about numerical quadrature. I'm going to try and give you an introduction in one slide here. And so what numerical quadrature does is it estimates, it tries to approximate an integral with this integrand by a linear combination or a weighted sum of the integrand evaluated at various points in the parameter space. Here we're integrating over the parameters. Okay. So here this is the weight or coefficient for each point, and this is the integrand evaluated at that point. In our case, the integrand is our coefficient function times our base learner characterized by the parameter set. Now, there are lots and lots of quadrature rules, but every quadrature rule for doing numerical integration is defined by its prescription for getting the evaluation points, and once you have the evaluation points, its prescription for the weights. Why didn't that work? Because I didn't do it right. Now, if we're going to use a quadrature formula to try and approximate our integral, okay, which would look like this, here is our integrand, and here are the weights assigned to each evaluation point. We can't separately identify the weight and the coefficient for that evaluation point, so we can simply express it in this form. Now, in principle, we could use a different set of weights and a different set of evaluation points for each prediction point of the predictor variables, but we're not going to do that. That's a bit ambitious. So we're going to average over prediction points and use a single set of parameter evaluation points and a single set of corresponding coefficients or weights for predicting at all values of X. So if we do that, then given any collection of prediction points, we know how to get the optimal weights or coefficients, how to combine these learners. Namely, we simply do, it's a linear model in the learners, and so we simply do a linear regression of the response using as predictors the base learners characterized by each of our parameter evaluation points. Now, so far, I'm assuming that we know the joint distribution. So this is optimal on the population. If you had an infinite amount of data, this is exactly what you would do, and it would be the optimal way to combine these learners. So our problem is, how do we find a good set of evaluation points? Because you might guess is that the accuracy of the quadrature rule is going to depend crucially on how we choose our quadrature points to integrate it. Now, among the parameters that characterize our most interesting base learners, there's a lot of them. And so these integrations are very high dimensional. And so among the most successful methods of dealing with high dimensional integrals, that is, high dimensional quadrature rules, are Monte Carlo methods. That is, you define a sampling distribution, say characterized by a probability density function on the parameter space. So this assigns a particular mass to each parameter evaluation point, each joint set of parameter values, okay? And then you draw from this distribution, IID, for example, okay? Now, in simple Monte Carlo, you might take this to be a constant everywhere in the space, so every base learner has an equal chance of being chosen, okay? And just as in classic Monte Carlo, that doesn't work very well. That's the parameter space is very large. Most parameter joint values of the parameter index base learners that are useless for prediction, and so you've got to do something better. And what you do better is what the people in the Monte Carlo business, again, lots of books written about important sampling, but it's called important sampling. That is, you customize the distribution that from which you draw the parameter points for each particular problem. And a particular problem is characterized by the target function. It's also characterized by the base learners that we've chosen. Okay. And what's the goal in constructing such a function? Well, what you want to do is you want to choose this probability density function on the parameter space so that it assigns high probabilities to points that are important to high accuracy when they're used with the other points in order to evaluate the numerical integral. So the idea is points that are most useful in a particular context and to achieving high accuracy, you want to make it more likely that they will be chosen when you randomly sample from this probability density function, and others that are less valuable will have less of a chance of being chosen. Now, Monte Carlo methods fall into, again, this is a little primer on Monte Carlo methods. As I said, many books have been written on all of this, each point of this, in fact. But there's two kinds of Monte Carlo for evaluating high-dimensional integrals. There's what you might call random Monte Carlo, in which you define the sampling density for your parameters, and then you draw the parameters IID from this density, which means that each parameter evaluation point is ignoring the others. It has no knowledge about the others that were also drawn, and which is kind of an approximation because these points are going to be used jointly to try and estimate the high-dimensional integral. But you're going to ignore that fact and just draw each point as if it were the only point and then use these points collectively. And we'll see later on that this corresponds to ensemble methods like bagging and random forest. They use this strategy. We'll see that in a little while. Okay. The other kind of Monte Carlo, which is generally, well, at least in the classic Monte Carlo literature, tends to be more successful, is what they call quasi-Monte Carlo, in which your points at which you evaluate the integral are set down in a deterministic manner such that each point accounts for the fact that it's going to be used with the other points. So in this case, you would assign importance to groups of points, not to individual points as you drew them. So each point is placed so it gives the best increase in accuracy in estimating your integral, given all the other points that are going to be used with it. So you might expect that might be a better strategy than IID, but of course it's far more difficult. So first of all, let's take a look at random Monte Carlo, okay? So that the importance of a point in getting an accurate estimate of our integral depends only on the value of that point. We're going to ignore the fact for the moment that it will be used with other points in combination to estimate our integral. And one measure of its lack, here I'm going to use lack of importance of the point, would be how good is that point, parameter evaluation point, if the corresponding base learner were used just by itself. In other words, I'm going to take one base learner, which will be characterized by a particular joint set of parameters, okay, and then this is the prediction risk if I use those parameter values, use that base learner based on these parameter values. The best single base learner would be the one that minimizes this expression. And that would represent, in a sense, the best single point rule, quadrature rule. That is, if you're only going to use one evaluation point, one integrand evaluation point, to do your integral, okay, this is the best point that you could use. And so the corresponding base learner would be the optimal single base learner. Now, you might expect that if I want to estimate an integral, especially a high-dimensional integral, a one-point rule is not likely to be terribly successful, but in fact, such things are routinely used. And it'll especially not be good if our target function is not one of the base learners, which is almost never the case. Okay? But it's often used. Whenever you do a single logistic regression or a single decision tree, that's what you're doing. You're doing using a single evaluation point to try and do that integral. And so it's not surprising that ensemble methods, which use basically more points to estimate that integral, tend to perform better. And again, I want to emphasize that this measure of how good a point is, or basically how bad a point is, the inverse of how good a point is, ignores the fact that this point is going to be used with other points in the quadrature rule. But you hope that if you do it this way, even ignoring the other points, and do your important sampling IID, that you'll do a lot better than the best single point rule. And given the success of things like bagging and random forest, that's clearly the case. Okay, so let's talk about partial important sampling, which is the strategy. Namely, our sampling distribution on the parameter space will be some monotonic decreasing function of the lack of importance of the point is defined as how good it is if it were used alone. Okay, so this is a monotone decreasing function. Since it's monotone decreasing, its location, its mode at least, will be at the best single base learner, because J of P is minimized by definition at P star, the best single base learner. But it will have non-zero values for other values of P, other values of P than P star. P star will be the most likely point to be chosen at each draw. Of course, you're going to be doing lots of draws, and each point, even the most likely point, doesn't have a lot of likelihood of being actually hit. But still, it'll be the most likely one, but we'll generate other points as well. If we want, we can define a distance between any point in the parameter space and the optimal point by the risk, the prediction risk of using that point minus the prediction risk of using the optimal point. And we'll use that in the next slide. Okay. So we have the location of our sampling distribution. It will be located at the best single base learner. But those of you who have worked in Monte Carlo, and especially important sampling, know that another critical parameter for important sampling is the scale or width of that sampling distribution, which I can define as the average distance from its center, say it's characterized by its mode. Okay. And that's controlled by the choice of this function g. Let me go back up here. That's controlled by the choice of this function g. Now, if we make that width too large, we'll be back in the regime of roughly making each parameter evaluation point in the whole space equally likely to be drawn. And in that case, we're not likely to do very well. On the other hand, if we make it too small, we'll also not do very well. Why? As sigma shrinks to zero, we'll just be repeatedly drawing base learners that are either at or very close to the best single base learner. And using the best one over and over again in an ensemble will not improve your accuracy at all. If you just repeatedly choose the same base learner and then just average, or you do a weighted average of those evaluations. Okay. So it's critical to choose the right width. And I've tried to illustrate that here with this picture here in the simplest application of classic Monte Carlo, but the concept is exactly the same. So let's suppose that this function here in black is a function that we want to integrate using Monte Carlo. Okay. And the colored curves represent different probability density functions for sampling points in a Monte Carlo quadrature rule to estimate the integral of this function. Okay. So this orange one down here is characterized by the fact that it's centered in the right place, but it has a huge width. I've only drawn this from minus 1 to 1, but this yellow one goes off to minus infinity and plus infinity. So it's going to put just a tiny fraction of its evaluation points in the region where the integrand is changing value. Because in this direction and this direction, it always has the same value, and you don't gain anything by drawing more points at the same value. Okay? Because they're all, the value of the integrand is zero. Okay, so this distribution is not likely to do well. Here's another one that has the right width, but it's located in the wrong place. So therefore, it again puts a small fraction of its sampling points where the integrand is important, namely where it's large and its values are changing. Okay. Here's another one, perhaps the most interesting one. This is a case where all of the evaluation points will be drawn in this range here, all where the integral is changing, but it fails to put points in other areas where the integrand is changing. And so you'll get, you can imagine, if you only draw points in here and do a weighted combination of them, say if your weights were all the same, you're not likely to get a good estimate of this integral because you don't integral because you don't know what the integrand is doing out here, and you don't know what it's doing out here. So you need the right location and the right width, and that's the green curve, which is centered near where the integrand is centered, and whose width is such that it puts all of its points in the region where the integrand is changing and covers the whole region where the integrand is changing. So that's the concept in classic Monte Carlo. The exact same concept goes over to the integral that we're trying to evaluate characterizing our ensemble method. So now we have two questions. First of all, how should we choose that width? Well, we even got a harder question. And the harder question is, how on earth are we going to sample from this distribution? I mean, you all know that even if the prediction risk of the base of a particular parameter base learner for a particular set of parameter values, even if that were in closed form, you all know that it's hard to efficiently sample from even, you know, a probability density that you have, arbitrary probability density that you have in closed form. But we don't even have this in closed form, right? We have an algorithm that can find it. Given P, we have an algorithm that can calculate J. Fine, but we want to draw P's. So how on earth are we going to do that? And these ensemble methods use a trick. And here is the trick. We call it perturbation sampling. And the idea is deceptively simple. That is, you randomly or modify, say, perturb the problem of finding the optimal base learners. And then you find the optimal base learner for the perturbed problem. Remember, we can solve the problem, in principle at least, for finding the optimal base learner. Here is the problem for finding the optimal base learner. That is, we find the set of parameter evaluation, the set of parameter values that minimize the expected loss over the joint distribution of the variables of predicting y with the base learner that corresponds to that particular parameter set. Okay. Now, this little r sub m means we're going to modify this problem and then find the optimal base learner for the modified problem. And we will control the width of our distribution by the degree to which we perturb this problem. So what can we perturb? Well, we can perturb the loss function. Instead of using our actual loss function, we can use a slightly different loss function. That'll give a different solution. Okay, and we can randomly perturb the loss function and then generate an ensemble of solutions. We can also perturb the sampling distribution, that is the joint distribution of the variables. We can perturb the algorithm, that's the argmin here that tries to solve this problem, or a hybrid of any or all of those. So let's examine each of those in turn. For example, suppose we decided we wanted to perturb the loss function. Well, here's one way to do it. We would say that to induce the mth base learner, the loss function that we will use will be our original loss function plus a random perturbation, where here this L sub m is a random function of y and f, and eta is a multiplier that just controls the degree of perturbation. That will be the width of our sampling distribution. Okay. Another way to do it, which we will see again when we talk about boosting, is to perturb the argument of the loss function. Instead of finding the function that minimizes the expected loss we're interested in, we find the function that when added to a random function of x, minimizes our loss criterion. So this is a random function of x. Okay. In either case, what we will do is we will find the optimal base learner for the perturbed problem. Then we will perturb it randomly again. We'll find another optimal base learner for the perturbed problem. None of these will be the optimal base learner for the original problem. But we'll get a distribution of base learners based on our distribution of parameter values. Okay, how about perturbing the data distribution? Well, you can do that by random re-weighting. That is, we take the joint distribution of our data, and we multiply it by a weight function which is a random function of the variables. So this is a random weight function that multiplies the original joint distribution of our variables, raised to the eta power, so that when eta equals zero, you don't have any perturbation, and as eta gets bigger, your perturbation gets larger and larger. And we'll see examples of this in a minute. Okay. And again, at each step, you randomly use a different random weight function, so you randomly perturb the joint distribution of the variables, then you find the optimal base learner using the original loss function, but with this modified data distribution, this modified joint distribution of the variables. And again, you will control the width of the sampling distribution by the value of eta here. The larger it is, the more dispersed your ensemble members will be, because the wider will be your distribution of parameter values. Or you can also perturb the algorithm, and that's fairly popular. And I've tried to indicate here by a random perturbation of the algorithm. And again, you'll control the width of your sampling distribution by the degree that you perturb the problem. Now, most algorithms that try and solve this problem, namely find the optimal p that minimizes this quantity, do it by doing repeated partial optimization on subsets of the parameters, and just keep doing that iteratively until they converge to a solution. And the way you perturb the algorithm is you perturb these partial solutions. And here's a couple of examples in the context of decision trees. Tom Dietrich, a long time ago, suggested when you build a regular decision tree, you split the data, you find the optimal partition of the data into two by finding the optimal variable to split on and the optimal place to split on it. And then you divide it in two and then recurse that procedure. I presume you all know about decision trees. Well, Dietrich's suggestion was, instead of finding the optimal split, find the best 20 splits and then randomly choose one of them at each step. That generates a random tree or a random base learner. Now, when we do it again, that random process, we'll get a different tree and we'll generate an ensemble of trees. Leo Bryman suggested a variant of this in which, instead of finding the optimal splitting variable over all possible variables, he chooses a random subset of the variables, generally a fairly small random subset of the variable, and finds the split on that randomly chosen subset, the optimal split on that randomly chosen subset. We'll come back to random forests in a minute. But those are two examples of perturbing the algorithm as opposed to perturbing the data distribution or the loss function. Now, what's the goal in all of this? Well, the goal in all of this is to produce a good set of parameter evaluation points. That is, a good set of base learner. And good means that when we optimally combine them in a linear model, that is, when we take the optimal linear combination of those base learners, we get a good approximation to our target function. Okay? And again, given a set of parameter evaluation points, that is, given a set of base learners that we've induced in one of these ways, then if we had an infinite amount of data and we knew the population joint distribution, we would optimally combine them, that is, find the optimal values of these coefficients by doing a linear regression based on whatever loss we're using of the response variable on our base learners. That gives us the optimal linear combination of the base learners, which is our quadrature formula. Of course, everything I've done so far, I haven't stressed this, depends upon knowing the population joint distribution. So we've been talking in a rather abstract framework. We don't have the population joint distribution, because if we had that, we could compute, at least with enough computing time, the optimal base learner. In fact, you can compute it this way. But we have finite data, which we presume to be a random sample from that joint distribution, which you can express this way. Namely, this is a Dirac delta function, and so our empirical distribution puts a mass of 1 over n, where n is the number of data points, at each of the data points. And we have to apply our perturbation sampling based upon this empirical distribution, namely the data set that we have, not on the population. Okay? Now, if we're going to modify the loss function, use that strategy, or modify the algorithm using, say, the random forest or the random trees algorithms, okay, it's straightforward. You just substitute the data empirical distribution for the population distribution and proceed algorithmically just as you would before, and you'd control the width of this distribution just as you did before. Pretty much the same pretty much the same story if you're going to perturb the data distribution. And if you want to perturb the data distribution, okay, instead of giving each data point a mass of 1 over n, that is a mass of 1 over n at each of the data points, you give a random mass at each of the data points. That is, you choose a random weight for each of the data points with expected value 1 over n. Okay, so the weights are drawn from some probability distribution, and the width of our sampling distribution, that is the dispersion of our base learners, will be controlled by the scale of this probability distribution. Its expected value will be 1 over n, and it will be controlled by scale, say the standard deviation. So the larger the standard deviation of this sampling distribution that you draw the weights, the more dispersed will be your parameter evaluation points, and thus the more dispersed will be your ensemble. Now, as we'll see later, it turns out, for computational purposes, the best weighting is to give the weights a value of either 0 or only two values, either 0 or 1 over k, where k is the number of non-zero weighted points, okay? Which you can do by drawing k points from the n without replacement. And if you do that, the standard deviation of the weights is given by this expression, so that the smaller the sample that you draw, that you use to induce each base learner, the more dispersion you will get, because k here is in the denominator, and you also reduce the computation by a factor of k over n, because those points that got zero weight don't have to be used in estimating the optimal base learner for the perturbed problem. So the perturbation would consist here in choosing a subset of the observations and giving them zero weight, and then using the others to induce the base learner. The fewer you use, the wider the distribution. Now, what about the quadrature coefficients? Okay, that's how you would do the perturbation sampling to induce our parameter evaluation points, or equivalently to induce our base learners. Okay, now we know if we had the population joint distribution, it's a linear regression of y on the base learners that we've gotten from whatever sampling technique that we want to use, and I've just written in its horrible detail what that is. The optimal coefficients are those that minimize the expected loss over the data distribution of when you predict y with that linear combination of the predictors. Now, when you have finite data, you have to change your strategy, as we all know, when all of us who have ever done regression. You have to do some form of regularization. Choose a subset of the variables, shrink the variables as you would in ridge regression. And it turns out, and there's not enough time to go into this in detail, but it turns out that the best strategy, or I don't know if it's the best, but a very good one, is to use what's called the lasso regression. So you choose the coefficients that minimize this expression. This expression up here is just the population version of that we had before, but we replaced the joint distribution of the variables with the empirical data. So this is the prediction risk on the actual data, and then we add to it a penalty, the strength of which is controlled by a parameter lambda, and this penalty penalizes the L1 distance of the coefficients from some predetermined values. Usually the predetermined values are zero, so this is just the sum of the absolute values of the coefficients, but there's nothing that says you can't use something else, and we'll see that some ensemble methods do use something else. Okay? So these C0s are some prior guess, usually zero. This strength parameter, of course, the solution will depend on the value of the strength parameter. And you choose the value of the strength parameter that gives you the best future prediction error as estimated by some sample reuse techniques such as cross-validation. Now, if you're going to do that, you're going to have a fast algorithm that can solve this problem for all values of the strength parameter so you can choose the best one. Okay? And in the last few years, such algorithms have been developed. We'll hear about several such algorithms as derived by Saharan and G later on this morning. And we've also derived algorithms that can do this very rapidly for basically arbitrary loss functions. And you use one of those techniques, and it is basically the emergence of those fast algorithms for solving this lasso problem for all values of the strength parameters, so you can choose the best one, that have made this whole approach possible. So there's a huge amount of intellectual content there that I'm skipping. In fact, that's a whole other talk that I might have given instead of this one. Okay, so let me summarize where we are so far. Where are we so far? Well, we're not too bad. Okay. This technique, this general paradigm that I talk about, we call important sample learning ensembles, or IELs. The basic idea is that we take as our approximation a linear combination of all possible base learners, which we approximate by a quadrature formula, where the sampling points for the parameters are obtained by important sampling from some probability density over the parameter space that we approximate with those perturbation sampling schemes that I just told you about. And then once you have those evaluation points, you do a regularized linear regression using that lasso of Y on your base learners to estimate their optimal combination. So if you've been sleeping till now, this is what I said. I tried to motivate it with the previous things, but that's basically the procedure. Okay, so let's take a look at some classic ensemble methods and see how they fit into this framework. And one of them is the bagging technique, and a very elegant, simple method derived by Leo Bryman back in 1996. And what bagging does, it's a classic IELTS, important sample learning ensemble, okay, that perturbs the data distribution in exactly the way that I mentioned. The perturbation is done by drawing drawing a bootstrap sample and finding the optimal base learner on the bootstrap sample. Now, a bootstrap sample can be considered as a randomly weighted, as a random weighting of the individual data points where the weights follow a multinomial distribution with expected value 1 over n. So it has expected value 1 over n. Okay? And then for that bootstrap sample, or equivalently randomly reweighted with a multinomial distribution, you find the optimal base learner on that bootstrap sample. And then to combine them, what bagging does is the simplest possible combination, that it sets all of the quadrature coefficients to the same value, 1 over m, so that your estimate is just a simple average of the base learners. So instead of trying to find an optimal linear combination of the base learners, you set all of the coefficients at the same value, so you produce a simple average. Now, the width of this distribution goes as 1 over n. And so with bagging, the larger your sample size, the narrower your distribution of base learners that you produce. And the same is true with Bayesian model averaging, that the more data you have, the narrower your posterior gets around. And that's fixed, and you have no control over that. So that's one potential problem. That's not a problem if your target function is one of the base learners. But as I said, that's almost never the case. Okay. And the other thing is there's no joint fitting of the coefficients. In other words, you can view setting all of the coefficients to the same value, 1 over m, independent of the data, as solving this problem where lambda is set to infinity and the C0s are all set to 1 over m. So a lot is made about the fact that bagging does not overfit. You can add more and more ensemble members, and you don't really increase the capacity of your learner. And the reason is it doesn't overfit because it doesn't fit. It does not fit the coefficients. So it doesn't overfit, which, you know, is both bad and good. Okay, so the question is, how might we improve bagging with what we've learned about general ensemble methods? We might use a different sampling strategy that changes the characteristic width, not just take 1 over n, whatever n has to be. And or we could set lambda less than infinity in that regularization term so that we jointly fit the coefficients to the data so as to try and estimate an optimal linear combination of the bagged ensemble rather than just taking an average. Random forest is another technique invented by Leo Bryman, very prolific man. And here he chooses a particular base learner, namely the largest possible decision tree that you can build on the data. Okay, and employs perturbation sampling, IID perturbation sampling, but with a hybrid strategy. Again, he draws bootstrap samples so that each the largest possible tree is built on a different bootstrap sample from the data. But then he does the random algorithm modification that I mentioned before. That is, at each split, you select the variable among a randomly chosen subset. And in his paper, he suggests this formula, namely, the log to the base 2 of the total number of parameters is the size of the subset. Now, Leo says the square root is better, but in the examples I'm going to show, they're about the same. There's 40 variables, so the log and the square root isn't too different. Okay, and then again, all the coefficients are set to 1 over m, so that the predictions are just the average of the ensemble. Okay. Now, if you look at random forest as an aisle, an important sample learning ensemble, its dispersion, the dispersion of the ensemble members for the same size tree at least, is greater than that for bagging because we've introduced the additional randomization in the variable selection part. The potential improvements by treating this as aisles are indeed the same, namely, whatever width you induce, it may not be the best width. And secondly, you might, as we'll see, can get dramatic gains by estimating the optimal linear combination of the random forest trees rather than just simply averaging. More later on that. Okay, so far, I've talked about basically IID Monte Carlo, namely bagging and random forest use that strategy. And in the perturbation sampling that I talked about that strategy. We randomly perturb the problem and find the best base learner for the perturbed problem. And the perturbations don't know about each other in what I've said so far. Each perturbation is random. It doesn't know how the data were perturbed or the loss function was perturbed the last time around or for the other members. Now, recall that I said at the very beginning that there's two kinds of Monte Carlo. There's random Monte Carlo, and then there's quasi Monte Carlo. And in quasi Monte Carlo, you put down the points in a deterministic manner so that each point is placed so that it best goes with the other points. So we have to assign importance or lack of importance to collections of points and find the best collection of points to do the interval. Once we find it for any collection of points that we entertain, we can always get, again, the optimal coefficients by doing a joint regression of y on the corresponding base learners that correspond to those evaluation points. Problem is that to examine all infinity choose m evaluation points would take more time than we have. And so we have to do an approximation to this, and again, in the classic quasi-Monte Carlo literature, they have approximations to this, because even there, it's a daunting problem. And it's generally based on sequential sampling, or what we'd call in statistics, forward stage-wise approach. And the idea here is, this is a complicated set of formulas, but I'll go through them. The idea is that we choose each parameter evaluation points to go best with the ones we've generated so far. We will not look into the future and ask, will it go well with the points we'll generate in the future? But we know the points we've generated in the past. And so we can say, place this point to optimally go with the points we've seen in the past in a joint quadrature rule based on the points so far. And that's what this expresses. Here, this h sub m of x is just a linear combination of the points, l equals 1 to m minus 1, that we've induced so far. And these are the corresponding coefficients. And what we do is find the function or the set of parameters that characterize the base learner, it goes best with those so far. Okay. Now, you probably don't remember, but let me remind you that this looks a lot like repeatedly modifying the loss function. When I talked about it there, I said, well, you add to f a random function of x. Here, we're not adding a random function of x. It's completely deterministic. It depends on the parameter evaluation points we've seen so far. And eta, again, is equal to 1. Okay, so this is a sequential sampling scheme that attempts to approximate a quasi-Monte Carlo, and this is pretty much the way they do it in classic Monte Carlo as well when they use sequential sampling schemes. Now, there's a connection to this sampling, this sequential sampling, and to boosting. Okay, now the eta boost algorithm, the first and probably still the most famous by Freund and Shapir, uses is intended for binary outcome variable, and it chooses as its loss function this exponential loss, and then takes as its prediction the sign of the linear combinations of the base learners. Okay, and basically, if you choose this loss function and follow this with this prediction, and use this, you'll and put this into the sequential strategy that I had on the previous slide, you get the Adabust algorithm. So it's sequentially sampling base learners. So each base learner is chosen to best go with the ones you've seen so far. The only approximation it makes, and all boosting makes, is it doesn't optimize the coefficients once it has the base learners. It uses the optimal coefficient that came with that base learner when it was induced into the ensemble. Okay. A more general technique that I call gradient boosting, okay, just generalizes this to general outcome variables and general loss functions, and then uses the linear combination of the ensemble as the in the same way that AdaBoost does to form the approximation. So how can we improve this with thinking about boosting as sort of a quasi-Monte Carlo aisle as opposed to a random Monte Carlo aisle? Well, basically what you can do is you can generate your base learners with the boosting technology, but then in the end go back and readjust the coefficients, because now when you've finished inducing all the base learners, you know all the parameter evaluation points, you know all the base learners, we can now go back and get the optimal coefficients, so at least the coefficients are all, the weights are all adjusted such that they account for all the other points. Okay, and we can also do hybrid strategies based on everything that's gone so far. Okay. So, unfortunately, this aisle technique is not a method. It's really just a paradigm. There are a wide variety of them, because as with any ensemble method, you have to choose your base learner. With any supervised learning problem, you have to choose your loss criterion. And in the case of aisle, you have to choose a perturbation method, the size of the perturbation. Okay, whether you do IID sampling, such as bagging a random forest, or sequential sampling, quasi-Monte Carlo, as in boosting, or hybrids of all of those. And so what we did, what time is it? Oh, it's about 10. Okay. What we did is examine several options here in a rather large Monte Carlo study. So let me describe the Monte Carlo study and then give you the results. The Monte Carlo study, we generated 100 data sets, each with 10,000 observations and 40 predictor variables. For each data set, the outcome variable was set equal to a target function plus randomly added noise, and the target function for each data set was different and itself randomly generated. The idea there is that the nature of the true target functions is one of the strongest things that characterizes how well a method will do in any given problem. And so we average over a large set of random data generated from a large set of different target functions. The X's, there were 40 predictor variables, okay, and then generated normally, and the additive error was set so that the signal-to-noise ratio was 1:1. So that there's a lot of noise in these problems. Signal-to-noise ratio is 1:1. Two evaluation criteria. How are we going to evaluate how different strategies actually do? One is the root mean squared prediction error, that is the root mean squared error of predicting the respective targets. Remember, the targets are different. And another criterion invented by Leo Breiman, which is awfully clever and very useful, is what at least I call the comparative mean squared error. That is, for each problem, you have a set of methods you're comparing, okay? You compute the root mean squared error of all of them. And then you divide the root mean square of all of them by the root mean square error of the best one, the one that had the smallest root mean squared error. So in each problem, that method will get a value of 1. All the others will get a larger value in proportion to how much worse they did than the best method. And this is a way of adjusting for the problem difficulty. Okay. So, properties of these target functions. 30 of the variables were pure noise. That was to kind of try and make it realistic as a data mining problem. It really only depended on 10 of the variables, and the others were just things, you know, that you might think of as being measured that have no predictive value whatsoever. It generates a wide variety of target functions in terms of their difficulty. They do emphasize lower order interactions. That sort of is my prejudice, that really high order interactions don't generally happen too much, and if they do, they're hard to estimate anyway. And most importantly, that none of these functions are in the span of the base learners, which we take to be decision trees. So none of these functions can be perfectly represented by a linear combination of decision trees. So they're outside the space of decision tree approximations. All right, so here are the results for a number of different kinds of bagged ensembles. And I'm not going to dwell on this too much, only to show you that for all of the bagged ensembles, I'll explain them in the next slide, that the range of root mean prediction error is rather large, ranges by over a factor of 2 for virtually all of the methods, indicating that they represent a wide range of difficulty for all of these methods. Okay, the more interesting plot is the comparative root mean squared error. And I'll go into this in a little bit of detail. Okay, here are the results for bagging the largest possible trees and then averaging the result. So these are all bagged ensembles of various kinds. And so the ensemble members were induced by bagging. Here, we simply, as in classic bagging, average the base learners. Here's what happens if we apply our strategy we call post-processing, which is to estimate the optimal coefficients for each of the trees. And you see, that doesn't improve anything at all in bagging. And the reason for that is that bagged trees, especially with 10,000 observations, have a very low dispersion. And so they're all those trees are fairly close to each other, and estimating the optimal coefficients doesn't help much. Here's what happens if you do bagging, but instead of drawing a bootstrap sample each time, you draw a 5% sample without replacement. So this introduces a much wider dispersion. You can think of bootstrap samples as being half samples without replacement. They're virtually the same thing. So this is a 5% sample. So we're building each tree not on a bootstrap sample of 10,000 observations, but on 5% of 10,000 observations. And you see, that doesn't work very well if you simply average the results. But here's what happens if you estimate the coefficients of the linear combination. And you see, that's already getting competitive with the straight bagging. The advantage of this is that you can build the trees 20 times faster because you're only using 5% of the data each time. Here we're changing the base learner. Here, instead of bagging the largest possible tree, which with 10,000 observations is typically of size 5,000 terminal nodes, so it's a mighty big tree. It takes a long time to build, too, but a mighty big tree. We're going to use 6 terminal node trees instead of 5,000 terminal node trees. And then, if we just average the results, this is the result. These are box plots of the comparative root mean squared error over the 100 trials, or the 100 data sets. So sometimes these did bad, sometimes they did well, and these are the median of the comparative root mean squared error. And that's a disaster. Instead of using the largest possible tree, if we only use 6 node trees, that's a disaster. If we simply average them, if we adjust the final coefficients, we do a lot better, but still not competitive at all with sort of traditional bagging. But here's the interesting one. If we bag 6 node trees on 5% of the data, this is what we do. In other words, certainly competitive with straight bagging, maybe even a little better. I mean, it was the best on almost every one of the 100 replications. And the advantage of this is you can build a 6-node tree 10 times faster than a 5,000-node tree. So you're gaining a factor of 10 there. You're gaining a factor of 20 because you're building the trees on only 5% of the data. And so you're gaining roughly a factor of 200. This is 200 times faster to induce the ensemble than this one. And it's just as accurate, perhaps a little better. Okay, here are some results for ensembles using the random forest strategy, if you recall, where you draw bootstrap samples and then you randomize the splitting as well. So here's classic random forest: build the largest possible tree, and then just simply average the results. Here's what happens if you take the same ensemble but adjust the coefficients. Try to estimate the optimal linear combination of those trees. And you see, you get a pretty big improvement. The improvement is about 20% improvement, 20-25%. And this is error, not squared error, we're talking about. Okay? So, and the reason why this happened for random forest and not for bagging is random forest increases the width of the ensemble over the straight bagged ensemble. And so when you have more dispersion, you get more improvement by adjusting the coefficients to estimate the optimal coefficients for the linear combination. That's what happened with bagging on the previous transparency. When we took a 5% sample, we got a huge dispersion in the trees, and then we did the optimal linear combination. And that if you just average it, the huge dispersion of trees does very badly. But when you weight them to give higher weight to the better ones, then they do just as well or slightly better. Okay. Here's what happens if you do random forests, but instead of using bootstrap samples, you use just 5% samples each time. And you see that is not quite as good as random forest with the post-processing, but a fair amount better than straight random forest. And here we're only building the trees on 5% samples. Here's random forest if you just use 6 terminal node trees, not the largest possible tree that you can build, which is 5,000 terminal nodes, but 6 terminal node trees and simply averaging. And that's not good at all. However, when you do that strategy and adjust the coefficients, you do as well as any of the random forest ensembles, in fact, and much better than you do with straight random forest. And here's if you go all the way, do random forest with 6 terminal node trees on 5% samples, and then adjust the coefficients. You do the best of all, get dramatic improvement, and again, you're doing something that's picking up a factor of 200 in the time it takes to build the ensemble. I mean, building those ensembles on 10,000 observations. I should say the ensembles all had 500 trees in them. Okay. So, I'm going to skip this. This just compares bagging and random forest. What I want to look now is at the quasi-Monte Carlo sequential sampling technique, where you derive the trees from boosting and then post-process the results. Remember, boosting is a little different because in its own way, sequentially tries to estimate weights for each of the trees. But those weights are estimated just given the trees it's seen so far, and no information about the trees it's likely to see in the future. Okay, so we take the same trees, but now we take advantage of the fact that when we've generated the trees, we know all the trees that are there, and so we're going to adjust the optimal coefficients for them. So here is one of the popular boosting methods, MART. Here's where we take the trees from MART, which is a boosting method, and post-process to get the optimal linear combination. And you see there's some improvement, but it's not nearly as large as what we were doing with the other ensembles. Keep in mind the scale here is a little different. So we're picking up, this is about 6%, and this is about 1.02. So we're picking up about a 5% improvement. Okay, this is if you generate trees with the boosting strategy, but instead of using all of the data, you use only 10% samples. And if you use that in the classic boosting strategy, that's a disaster. But again, if you post-process the coefficients, it's competitive with straight boosting. And here is the case where instead of taking 10% samples, we take 20% samples, which in this problem just happens to do the best and does better than any of them. Okay, here is a comparison of the sequential strategy that mocks quasi-Monte Carlo, namely the boosting strategy, compared to the IID strategy, which is central to bagging and random forest. And what we see here is here is boost, straight boosting, here is boosting post-process, here is the best of the sequential ensembles post-process, here's straight bagging, here's the best bagged ensemble, 6 node trees, 5% of the data. Here's straight random forest, the best random forest ensemble. What we see here is what people observe in the classic Monte Carlo literature, namely that quasi-Monte Carlo for high-dimensional integration tends to work better than random Monte Carlo. Okay, and I'd like to then finish up. I'm going to skip this one and give you one real data set. This has all been Monte Carlo, and that will be it. And this is the SPAM data set that was used in the KDD Cup data mining competition at the KDD conference, I don't know, a few years ago. And the data set consists of around 19,000 emails. And the problem is to separate spam emails from real emails, a problem we're all painfully aware of. And the results I'm going to show you, we took the 19,000 and split it into a training set of around 15,000, then a 4,000 test set. Did that 5 times with different random partitions, and those are the results I'm going to show you. Okay. Now the Y, of course, is binary, spam or not spam, and there were 833 predictor variables, 19,000 observations, 833 predictor variables, and these predictor variables were all binary features of the email message that indicated presence or absence of certain aspects, namely selected text, presence or absence of selected text strings, characteristics of the header, characteristics of the URL, etc. And so for that, we have to change programs here. And I think I've got that here. So here are the results of various kinds of ensembles. I guess you can't see that. I'm having trouble seeing it here. First of all, these are the error rates. straight error rates. Notice that all methods are giving very low error rates. So all of these methods, based on that data set, would produce a pretty good spam filter. Okay. So here's bagging. Here is bagging, where we adjust the coefficients. Again, no improvement, maybe a slight. Here's bagging on 1% of the data, bagging 10 node trees. Here the trees are a little larger because the data set's a bit bigger, so we decided to use larger trees. But only using 1% of the data, not 5% that I was talking about before, but each tree is induced on only 1% of the 15,000 observations. Okay. Here's random forests, classic random forests where you average. Here's random forests, but where you adjust the coefficients of the linear combination in the estimated optimal way. Okay, here is random forests where instead of using bootstrap samples, you use 1% samples each time to induce the trees. Again, and 10 terminal nodes in the trees instead of the largest possible tree, which in this case would have about 7,000 or 8,000 terminal nodes. Here's MART, which is straight boosting, and here are various variants. And so what we see here is all of these methods, except random forests, which are doing a bit worse than the other techniques, still rather well, but a bit worse than the others. But as soon as we post-process a random forest by adjusting the optimal linear combination, it does as well as the best among here. Okay, so that, no, I can't do that here. And also, if you remember the results from the Monte Carlo, they're very similar to what we're seeing here. The reason why, I should point out, why in this particular problem, and this is not necessarily a general characteristic of random forest, is because we have 833 variables. And it's probably the case that of all those 833 variables, a fairly small fraction of them are really important in distinguishing spam from not spam. And so the random selection of the variables inherent in the random forest is at a real disadvantage there. When that's not the case, when all of the variables are roughly equally relevant, then random forests are competitive with everything. But in a lot of problems, you know, especially data mining, where people measure everything because the data is collected not for the purpose you happen to be using it for now, you tend to be lots and lots of irrelevant variables. But in pattern recognition applications, for example, there tend to be less irrelevant variables. All right. So now let's go back here. So let me... I didn't want to do that. There we go. Summary. Okay, one of the things is from a theoretical, if not mathematical, perspective, what we tried to do is unify the more popular ensemble methods, bagging, random forest, and Bayesian model averaging, which I didn't get a chance to talk about. You can, of course, use this technique with base learners generated from Bayesian model averaging techniques. One of the nice things is that by estimating the optimal linear combination, rather than just averaging, which is what Bayesian model averaging does, that you can remove the restriction that the base learner that the target function has to be one of your base learners, because now you're trying to find the optimal linear combination to predict the base learner amongst your ensemble, rather than just taking the average. And the average is motivated by the fact that the target function is one of your ensemble members. Okay, so we tried to unify. In the paper, we talk about this. I didn't talk about it here. And boosting. Into a single paradigm based on Monte Carlo integration. The first three, bagging, random forest, and Bayesian model averaging, use an IID technique. That is, each point is sampled without knowledge of the other points that had been sampled. The first two use this perturbation sampling strategy that I talked about. Of course, Bayesian model averaging generally uses some form of Markov chain Monte Carlo, which is a bit more expensive. But again, another point that if you estimate, instead of just taking the average in Bayesian model averaging, you try and estimate the optimal linear combination, you remove the constraint of burn-in. Because all we want is a collection of base learners. And we don't really care if we are, with the sequential MCMC, whether we are actually getting a good approximation to the IID distribution. So burn-in is much less of a problem if you estimate the optimal coefficients, even if you generate your base learners with MCMC, although generally that's very much slower than either of any of these. Okay, and the fourth one, boosting, it corresponds to a quasi-Monte Carlo technique, Monte Carlo integration using quasi-Monte Carlo, which we approximate by sequential sampling. And I was going to talk about future directions. I don't think I will, because my time is over. So what I will do is just give you some references there. Slides of this talk can be downloaded from here, and there are two papers that describe this work. This is the paper that describes what I talked about here, and this is a paper that describes our approach to estimating these large linear models based on lasso and other penalties and other loss functions. So with that, I thank you very much.